legacies of the Esquimalt and Nanaimo land grants. Essentially, we're talking about a dynamic within Vancouver Island, as it's called, where we're seeing traditional indigenous territories being offered up to forestry companies for quote-unquote development. Land grabbing is a term that's used globally that speaks to dynamics of neocolonialism, and those dynamics are at play on Vancouver Island today in the context of Canada. So I think that this initiative is really an important window into understanding the dynamics of policy around colonial acquisition of Indigenous territories as it's tied up with corporate infrastructure and extraction projects in the context of Vancouver Island. It's at greatlandgrab.com. So I spoke with Mike about this project, and I'm really happy to feature that conversation here today on Free City Radio. There has been some focus on thinking about this process of what has been called land grabbing in contexts of the Global South. There's been quite a lot of interesting research connected to social movements through an organization called GRAIN that has documented what this looks like on the ground in communities, for example, in Madagascar and other contexts, grain.org, for anybody who's listening who'd like to check out that research. Mike, you've looked at what land grabbing, you know, to use a term, looks like on Vancouver Island and also in British Columbia. And I really was struck by the project, particularly because it brings up a lot of intersecting questions around financialization of territory, questions about Indigenous sovereignty, and of course, ecological justice. So maybe if you could just first start by introducing yourself and just giving an outline as to some of the key issues that you have been addressing and looking into through your research on land grabbing in British Columbia, Canada.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Stefan. My name is Mike Eakers. I'm a faculty member in human geography at University of Toronto Scarborough, and I have an appointment downtown in geography and planning, and that's where my graduate work with MA students, PhD students is located. I've been a researcher for well over 20 years now. Most of that has been focused on British Columbia, very much centered on forestry, and around 10 years ago now or so, I got involved in a large research project, or I guess I've been at the forefront of it, centered on how finance capital was moving rather aggressively into BC forest lands. And this felt like a really new moment in BC forest politics. And to be clear, finance has always been involved, merger, acquisitions. But this was a different sort of finance. This was a finance capital that wasn't concerned with owning traditional forestry companies that might have processing facilities, pulp, paper mills, sawmills, and whatnot. These were a different kind of actor coming from Toronto, largely with Brookfield Asset Management. And there was a dramatic shift in how the forestry sector specific to private land was being managed. So if historically a lot of companies were focused on manufacturing tied to their harvesting activities, suddenly you had a series of companies, Island Timberlands and Timber West, that were uniquely focused on private land and log exports. So that doesn't answer the land grabbing question. So land grabbing is this understood, I think, generally as focused on the large-scale acquisition of land, the enclosure of that land, assertion of private property rights at the expense of other quote-unquote users or other claims to that territory or to that land, and the bundling up of this land as asset, at times for productive use, but often also for speculative purposes. So land grabbing in this context, you could say all of North America has been land grabbed since colonial settlement. And I think that that is true. But land grabbing takes different shapes and forms in different historical moments. So the land grabbing that, say, grain is focused on, or that we've been focused on in some of this work that we've done, really stems from a series of speculative bubbles. Whether that is kind of the tech crisis in what, the 80s and 90s, the Thai crisis in Southeast Asia, the speculative bubbles around housing that kind of came to a head 2007, 2008. So along that kind of bumpy road of speculative bubbles on different kinds of assets, suddenly land, agricultural land, forestry land became incredibly attractive as a stable asset, as something real, something physical, something material that wouldn't necessarily be subject to the same booms and busts as a lot of other assets that finance had been focused on probably since the late 1970s.
Just to sort of thread a little bit of what you're saying here, the link to financial bubbles is interesting and important, just to underline that. Finance capital and the sort of process of speculative investment, seeking out new quote-unquote frontiers, if we want to use directly colonial language, which I think in this context is appropriate, frontiers that can ensure investment viability for basically finance capital markets. So outside of the discourse, you mentioned Brookfield Management, which is obviously important in relation to Mark Carney, current PM of Canada. Just maybe talk a bit about this sort of vortex of financial capital and quote-unquote new investments, and maybe just break it down a bit for people who might not be as tuned into sort of the discourse framework that you're sharing.
Yeah, I think I'd say two things to that. I think the first is just providing a bit more of a genealogy that's a bit more focused on some of the transformations that happened. So I think historically, a lot of BC forest lands in the Canadian context, also the US, also northern Western Europe, were in the 20th century, were managed by big industrial companies. Industrial companies that had rights to harvest and also had processing facilities, again, pulp and paper operations, sawmills, you know, producing the lumber that, say, houses are made out of, for instance. And those industrial companies in the Canadian context, also the U.S., ran into massive economic, social, political headwinds in the 1980s. Whether that was the assertion of an exercise of, say, Aboriginal rights and title, different Indigenous claims to territory, whether that was the war in the woods, environmental campaigns against old growth logging, but also political economic challenges, the rise of the U.S. South as a major timber producer, lower labor cost, much more nimble, smaller companies. Anyhow, there was a real transformation that occurred from kind of industrial ownership to financial ownership. And these were new corporate knights in the woods, if you will. So there's a broader kind of change that happened from our economies being dominated by industrial players in the state, the government jumping up and down to keep them happy. And then, you know, throughout the 1990s, early 2000s, and probably before that, definitely before that, finance capital becomes the figurehead of capital, of capitalism. And part of that took the shape of new forms of ownership, new policies, new legislation that catered to finance capital. But you certainly see more profits coming through financial firms than you do through industrial firms. So that's some of the broad changes that occurred. I think that your question, I think, was a bit more specifically focused on this question of frontiers, the relationship of finance to frontier spaces. I think that's an interesting question. So capital has always required a certain kind of outside, if you will, new spaces, new land, new labor, things that had previously perhaps not been commodified or had been commodified under earlier kind of industrial regimes. And capitalism has a built-in need to grow. If it doesn't grow, we have recessions. People lose their jobs, the most precarious people, the working class, people of color, etc., are disproportionately impacted. So capital always needs an outside to grow, or it has to reinvent the inside, if you will. So it's always required a certain kind of frontier. So historically, colonialism was that frontier that was acquiring new territory, dispossessing indigenous people, in this case, of their land, for settlement, for the development of export markets from the industrial core or the kind of imperial core, and then kind of the enrollment of labor, often people of color. And the enrollment of resources into the circuits of capital. So historically, capitalism has always had this kind of voracious appetite for a frontier that becomes a means through which crisis is negotiated. So if you have a crisis in the core, well, one of the things you can do is kind of reignite the economy, if you will, through expansion. And all the kind of political, economic apparatus investment that goes with that. And then part of that expansion then is the extraction of labor, the extraction of resources, that shores up the economy in quote unquote the colonial core, or sorry, the imperial core. So, I think that that is right. I think that that's kind of a broad sensibility that kind of informs this work. And we've been trying to make the arguments in this research that these forest lands, these private forest lands, to some degree, represent one of these kind of frontiers. You know, the making of private forest land as an asset is essentially the making of a frontier through which financial capital has been able to kind of extract tremendous value from indigenous territory. I'm happy to talk about kind of the actual mechanisms through which that happened.
I think talking about those mechanisms of that transfer of territorial wealth is interesting and important. Going back to just thinking about this on a conceptual level and also just a territorial level. So we're talking essentially about important point that you mentioned, Mike, which I just want to underline, which is the shift from sort of the imaginary, I think, today still around capitalism is rooted in this idea that industrial style companies produce wealth, right? And I think on a popular level, there still hasn't really been a discourse shift in terms of understanding how the shift of power has transferred to financialization, right? And this is such an important and essential example in the Canadian context to think about that process of financialization and how it actually is tied to the inherent character of the Canadian state project. When it comes to the territorial realities you're talking about, can you maybe just describe on a sort of physical level, where are we talking about? What is the land we're talking about? Whose land are we talking about? Just for people to sort of visualize and get a sense of where we're talking about on a geographic level.
Yeah, so I'm currently speaking to you from Victoria, BC. Kind of unceded Coast Salish territory, although some of Victoria and kind of the capital region, as it's described, is subject to certain treaties, the Douglas Treaties, from the mid 19th century. Anyhow, most of Vancouver Island, which is the area we're focused on in our research, is unceded Indigenous territory. And what I mean by that is that there's never been any treaty signed between the Crown outside of these Douglas treaties, and nor was there any kind of surrender or ceding of title to the Crown. So the vast majority of First Nations on Vancouver Island, so Coast Salish Nations, Halkwaminim Nations, which are part of the kind of Coast Salish language group, the Chalnuth Nations, these are the communities that have been impacted directly by these land grants or the creation of this kind of private land. So our research is focused on these 19th century land grants to the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railway Company from 1887 that created over 800,000 hectares of private land. So that specifically affected Coast Salish and the Chalnuth Nations. There's other language groups, other nations on the island, but those are the ones impacted most directly by these land grants. So that would be the southeastern portion of Vancouver Island, running from Souk, a lovely place with potholes to swim on a gorgeous river, all the way north to Campbell River. So it's a 20-mile belt, 32 kilometers wide, and it's about, you know, 22-23% of Vancouver Island. So it's a massive portion of Vancouver Island. It's probably about 4 hours to drive from top to bottom, just to give you a sense of the scale. And pre-settlement, pre-kind of colonialism, these would have been incredibly lush, rich forests of predominantly Douglas fir. A lot of the iconic old growth that BC is known for is found on Vancouver Island. These weren't necessarily quote-unquote pristine, untouched kind of wilderness spaces. First Nations, Indigenous communities have long had very active relationships to the forest. You'll see that in terms of culturally modified trees. You'll see that in terms of relationships around gathering medicinal plants, gathering food, hunting, the use of wood for ceremony, for canoes. So colonial settlers saw an empty wilderness that was kind of viewed as a colonial bounty. But these were spaces that Indigenous communities have inhabited for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and with kind of rich cultural, spiritual, legal relationships to these territories. So out of this unceded territory, through a series of colonial processes, legislation, and a land grab, this territory was transformed into a massive belt of private property. So it's taking rich, lush landscapes with full of kind of Indigenous content and transforming them into a site of profound resource extraction that has fundamentally changed the trajectory of Indigenous nations on the island, and also the prospects of settlers, forestry companies, the state, and whatnot.
Thanks for outlining all of that, Mike. For anybody who's hearing this on a local FM or AM station, or even CFUV in Victoria, 101.9 FM, you can visit soundcloud.com/freecityradio and just look for this episode on land grabbing on Vancouver Island, if you'd like to re-listen, because there's a lot of details in there. Mike, you described this colonial sort of administrative shift, right? And I mean, that sounds like a light term, but, you know, we're talking about a regime change, essentially, of governance, right? And, you know, one of the sort of discourse points that has come up in politics in the contemporary context in Canada is, quote unquote, economic opportunity, right? And for example, Mark Carney, who's tied to investment capital and financialization, which you're addressing in your work, has sort of tried to, and also the Trudeau during the terms of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, had a sort of similar discourse of this idea that it's a progressive framework to think about economic quote-unquote opportunity for Indigenous people, right? But this kind of removes a pretty essential shift of power, right? So maybe, given that there's like so many layers to this conversation, thanks for describing the actual land that we're talking about. Maybe we can just sort of focus a bit on why this research work is important today to inform an understanding of the actual territorial realities of financialization in Canada today, and how that informs the politics of, the national power, which is administered by the Liberal Party of Canada.
I think one thing I would say is that often I think we view finance capital in the abstract. It's this big, mighty thing that shapes our worlds in ways that we don't understand. The subprime crisis, in some ways, was really simple. In some ways, it was profoundly complicated. It entailed a massive transformation of wealth and value from homeowners that were given predatory, essentially fraudulent loans. And the banks, the investment firms, were bailed out and homeowners were not. So sometimes finance capital is incredibly tangible. But I think often in our imagination, we think of Brookfield, we think of sovereign wealth funds, we think of pension plans. And they're often black boxes. They're involved in incredibly complicated financial maneuvering, the creation of assets, insurance, reinsurance. And it's almost like they mystically or magically produce value out of trading things. Like you and I could go right now and buy 100,000 bushels of wheat to be delivered to us in 2030. You and I are not going to consume all those bushels of wheat. But what we're hoping is that those bushels of wheat will be worth more than they are now. So we never think that they will be delivered to us. We hope that they will increase in value and we can sell them to someone else and make a profit. Anyway, so financialization has been, again, it's seen as a black box, but if you start kind of pulling different threads, you can see how it's quite tangible. So I think one thing we've tried to do with this research is understand its kind of concrete material maneuverings and implications, with a real focus on the relationship between creating and protecting private property to forest lands and how that intersects with Indigenous rights, title, jurisdiction to that same land. So we've been really focused on, as researchers, but also as people involved in kind of public dialogue, and some policy interventions about the double life of this land as financial asset and as Indigenous territory. These things coexist unhappily in a very contradictory, complicated way, but this land has at least a double life that is those two things. And I think that matters because if you say, okay, how do we understand these land grants historically and in the contemporary moment, I think it's really incumbent on us to pull both of those threads. The thread of colonial enclosure, the creation of private property in the 19th century, and pulling that all the way through to kind of the contemporary moment, which is a journey through industrial capital, CP Rail, Canadian Pacific Railway in the 20th century, through to the industrial giants, McMillan Bloedel, pardon me, Crown Zellerbach, through to kind of a much more financialized regime now. On the other hand, if you pull the other thread that is Indigenous rights, title, jurisdiction, you have 150 years of opposition to the railway, to the land grants, to the railway being pushed through reserves initially in the 19th century, to different assertions and exercise and kind of legal campaigning for the recognition of in legal terms, Aboriginal title. And that's ongoing. There's a recent court decision through which the Cowichan Nations, their Aboriginal title has been recognized to an island in Richmond called Lulu Island, Clictinus. And this has opened up ways to think about the coexistence of Aboriginal title and private property. So your actual question was, like, how does this actually work in terms of finance? So the Clactinus case doesn't help with that. But I think what I've tried to articulate here, it's a bit of a long answer, I apologize for that, is the ways in which finance has to deal with complicated material landscapes, social, cultural, political, legal spaces. So it's never investing in kind of an empty frontier landscape. It's investing historically and in the contemporary moment into very complicated spaces where contestation, in many respects, is built in.
Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to outline this today. And just quickly, the website of your research initiatives.
Yeah, the website is greatlandgrab.com. And most of our research is up there. Most of our writing is up there. Some wonderful maps that kind of detail this in a much more visual way than I've been able to kind of speak to today.
That was a conversation with Mike Eckers, who works on the initiative called Great Land Grab. You can find them at greatlandgrab.com. I think it's an important project that offers a spotlight into the dynamics of neo-colonial territorial conquest today on Vancouver Island. Thanks to Mike for being on the program this week. Free City Radio is supported in 2025 by the Social Justice Center at Concordia University, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CGSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Stefan Christoph, and I'll speak to you next week.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. If you missed your favorite program, don't worry. You can listen to podcasts of our program at cjsf.ca.